I next met with Dr. Zev Wainberg from the UCLA Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So this was a typical patient who presented to the clinic with newly diagnosed disease, with having had already a surgery at an outside institution in a liver nodule that was biopsied and confirmed to be moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. So we knew at that point that he had at least one to two good liver lesions that were not resected entirely because of their size, but were present at the time of diagnosis. So at that point, we did a thorough analysis of his tumor and his lymph nodes. He had actually only seven lymph nodes removed that were positive. His tumor was RAS wild type and RAF wild type. And he did have, interestingly, the suggestion, at least on the immunohistochemistry, that he might be microsatellite unstable. But at that point, we didn't know much about MSI testing, to be honest with you. But that's where we were with that case.
So what happened?
So, you know, he had disease that was in the liver, and by the time we restaged him in early 2014, February 2014, he actually had multiple liver lesions at that point. So he went pretty fast from being a guy who had one or two liver lesions to, in the end of 2013, to by March of 2014 or so, having about 10 liver lesions. So we felt at that point there's no way we can resect him at that point. So we started him on chemo, combination chemo, and he was on FOLFOX Bev for a while. Had a good response clinically by imaging and CEA. And he was on that regimen for about 6 months.
Can I just clarify, was the primary right or left-sided?
So he was a right-sided primary.
And he had a BRAF V600E mutation?
At that point in time, he had a BRAF V600E mutation and no family history of colorectal cancer. And we did immunohistochemistry mismatch repair genes on him from the primary diagnosis. And there was the loss of MLH1. So he didn't have any family history, though. So at that point, we were pretty suspicious that this was a microsatellite unstable tumor. Bear in mind that at that point in 2014, microsatellite instability was being done more out of interest rather than for any practical reason.
I guess for, you know, family genetic reasons, really.
Yeah, family genetics.
Wow. Well, things change, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I was just curious about the location, because I've been polling GI investigators lately about an interesting thing that Alan Vanook stated to me in an interview a couple weeks ago, which is nowadays when he sees right-sided metastatic disease, he's thinking about FOLFOXIRI.
Right.
Even without a BRAF mutation. Is that something, you know, I find not everybody's quite on board with that. What do you think about that?
You know, in the absence of a BRAF mutation, I don't personally do that. And I don't know if, I mean, I understand conceptually why you would, because the prognosis is worse, and they've demonstrated that the prognostic significance of that right side is just worse for whatever reason, for lots of reasons. But, you know, the practical problem with doing that, the way I see it as someone who treats a lot of these patients, is even though you're going to give FOLFOXIRI to those folks, you need to consider the fact that if they don't have a BRAF mutation, their prognosis isn't quite as bad. So, you know, you got to start thinking about second-line regimens and all of that, and you wonder if FOLFOXIRI is the right regimen for all patients with right-sided tumors.
You know, I don't think he's saying that, I mean, exactly, but I think it was more that his trigger finger, so to speak. I mean, this patient sounds like he really didn't do that well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those patients where his liver lesions were at the time of surgery, so we already knew we were dealing with a metastatic disease at diagnosis, and things got worse in a matter of a few months. He did have a nice response to FOLFOX-BEV in terms of, you know, PR by imaging. Nothing went away definitively. We were still dealing with an unresectable situation. So at that point in time, you know, we did consider liver resection, but more or less there was no way to resect all gross disease in this patient. And even though he didn't have extensive extrahepatic disease, he had a number of liver lesions that were just felt to be a big problem. So we changed him to FOLFIRI at that point, because by 6 months later after FOLFOX-BEV, it was clear that it stopped working. He had new liver lesions. He had a rise in CEA. So it was pretty clear that he was progressing.
Just out of curiosity, why not BEV, aflibercept, or ramucirumab?
So he ended up having some hypertension towards the end of his regimen. And I think after 6 months of BEV, his hypertension actually became a little more challenging to deal with. And so VEGF inhibitors were problematic. At that point in time, you know, and again, this is a few years ago, with the BRAF mutation and the MSI, we weren't sure what to do with the EGFR inhibitors either. We were facing this question, should we pull the trigger on cetuximab combination with FOLFIRI, which, as you know, in the BRAF literature, it's gone back and forth a number of times. NCCN guidelines took it out for a number of years, then they put it back as an option. So, you know, the question is, EGFR inhibitor role in this kind of BRAF mutation was difficult to know what to do. So we had a problem with the VEGF inhibitors by that point that made, you know, further VEGF inhibitor use look like it would be a problem. He was already on two antihypertensives and he had a vague cardiac history, so I didn't feel comfortable pushing too much further.
So this man, obviously, now that we kind of got into the modern era, had the option of a checkpoint inhibitor, but I'm just kind of curious, since he did have a BRAF mutation, what your take is on targeted therapy of patients with a colon cancer and BRAF mutation. We saw some data actually on the same program. Scott Kobetz talked about the trial he presented at ASCO. You might want to talk about that. Globally, what's your take on targeted therapy? And, you know, assuming the patient's not MSI high, how do you integrate targeted therapy into non-protocol management of these patients?
In the BRAF mutation patients in particular? So, I mean, I think in the non-MSI BRAF mutant patients, which are the more common and a very bad prognosis, as we know, you know, that's not the biggest group of patients, but if we're going to say it's 8 to 10% of our patients with metastatic colon cancer, I think the data that Scott presented was very compelling, that the combination of irinotecan, cetuximab, vemurafenib is an active regimen in these people. I personally looked at that regimen, that SWOG trial that was presented, and I thought, you know, I saw the first data, I was less impressed, but then I saw the randomized data separating the curves and clear, you know, no survival advantage yet, but that's small numbers and short follow-up, but PFS advantage, it's pretty clear. And the patients who get irinotecan, cetuximab, and vemurafenib, I found that compelling enough that I think those patients should get that, should get a BRAF inhibitor in the mix. I think, you know, we'll see those approved pretty soon. As you know, there's a bunch of BRAF inhibitors out there that are looking at the same paradigm, whether it's with EGFR inhibitor or with chemo is one school of thought that Scott put forward, which I think makes good sense. The other one is to forgo the chemo part of it and give them the BRAF inhibitor and the MEK inhibitor and try to block downstream of that. So there's different ways to get at that BRAF mutation. I do think that we'll be in an era pretty soon where BRAF mutant colon cancer patients will be treated with a BRAF inhibitor as part of their regimen.
And I see that you've been involved with work looking at, well, first I see encorafenib and cetuximab, another trial looking at dabrafenib, trametinib. What do you see with these patients clinically, particularly with their skin?
So these are not easy drugs. I mean, the simple problem is that the skin toxicity is a big one when you add in two drugs that cause skin toxicity. So all patients need to be really, we're very aggressive with the antibiotics in these people from the get-go, perhaps even more aggressive than we would be if they were on single-agent EGFR inhibitors. The dabrafenib-trametinib combination, which is probably a lot of folks know pretty well about that combination from multiple cancers, is, you know, there are some other issues beyond rash that are challenging. I would say fevers are a very common problem, as is fatigue and LFT abnormalities. So those drugs need to be dosed, you know, carefully.
Could I just ask you, I mean, that combination is actually approved in lung cancer now, and some people are using it first line, but would you use that combination outside a trial setting in BRAF mutated colon cancer?
Not yet. I think if I was going to use a BRAF inhibitor in colon cancer off trial, I would choose Scott's regimen. I would choose the irinotecan, cetuximab, vemurafenib, because I think that is probably the furthest along. It's got good randomized data. And I personally think the idea of giving some cytotoxic chemotherapy in those people is probably a good idea. And by that, I mean, if they're irinotecan naive in particular, and they're BRAF mutated, irinotecan, cetuximab, vemurafenib to me is a good way to go. There's a bunch of trials. There's actually a randomized trial. Encorafenib's doing a randomized trial with their MEK inhibitor and with cetuximab, and they're randomizing people to irinotecan cetuximab versus their triplet or their doublet. So there is a lot of effort now going into this.
Of course, this patient had another option because of the MSI high status. What happened?
So this patient got referred to me, you know, and I sent him back actually to a community oncologist while he was getting FOLFIRI, and then this business of the MSI started to emerge as a real thing, as a real actionable thing, as opposed to, you know, just a hypothetical, theoretical. That was the early days, I'd say, in 2014 or mid-2015, I guess, a couple of years ago. And data started to emerge that these people with MSI had some anecdotal responses to checkpoint inhibitors. So we tried to get this patient on a clinical trial, actually, because that would have been the ideal way. And then he was excluded from clinical trial participation because he had some comorbidities that were considered ineligible for a clinical trial. So we ended up at that point applying for nivolumab. And by that I mean, you know, once it became clear that the nivolumab was active in those patients, it became relatively easy, as we all know, to get it. So we started him on that. And this has been my, I'd say, my best response to nivolumab. He's been on that drug for 2 years. And he has disease that responded immediately. After 1 to 2 doses, his liver disease started to shrink. His CEA started to come down. He had evidence of clinical response, too, because by the time we started, he was already having some clinical problems.
Any tolerability issues? Any autoimmune toxicities?
You know, other than the laboratory abnormalities of some mildly elevated TSH, he hasn't had any. So a very well-tolerated patient.
What have you seen in general with checkpoint inhibitors? I'm guessing most of them have been in MSI patients. Anything unusual in terms of toxicities or problems?
I think now, a year ago, people were even using this in MSS patients because there was some hope, and I dosed some myself, and I haven't seen any benefit there. It's clear that it doesn't work, single agent. I think in the MSI high, the responses are pretty striking, I find. Not every patient, but a majority of patients have some clinical benefit, even if, like this patient used in the third line. I mean, there are some toxicities, obviously. There's some cumulative fatigue, and there's some degree of, some patients can get your pneumonitis and colitis. I haven't seen it that much in these MSI patients. And to be fair, my experience with these drugs is usually in the GI settings, which is a little different.
Any thoughts about the possibility of discontinuing therapy in this man? And in general, how do you think through that issue?
That's a good question. And I think that's the next topic of discussion, particularly in MSI high, is that the data now, we don't have any data on should you discontinue patients who still have active disease. So he still has liver mets that are clearly visible. He's been on it, though, for 2 years. And there are randomized trials in other malignancies that are looking at that very question, 1 year versus 2 year discontinuation. And I think biologically, this is the kind of patient who you could probably stop it and perhaps sustain the same degree of benefit. But I was probably going to do that pending that result in the other cancer that shows, if there's no difference between the patients who stop at 2 years or 1 year, I was going to suggest that in this particular patient because it's been a long time and we're not seeing further response. We stopped seeing that long ago. We're seeing continued stable disease. He still has liver lesions.
Any issue in terms of the duration between therapies when you're using nivolumab? Right now, it's every 2 weeks. Here's this man coming in now every 2 weeks, more than 2 years. I've heard people talk about using every 4 weeks. What do we know about prolonging the schedule?
So I think in certain cancers, that's now becoming a backbone. And it's clear that in pembrolizumab, they have a fixed dose every 3 weeks. So with Nivo, every 4 weeks, I think there is pretty good data for that. He doesn't really come in every 2 weeks for 2 years in the sense that this is the kind of patient we give frequent breaks to because he's doing so well.
Really?
So he travels. I'd say he comes in 2 weeks and then takes a break for a week and goes on vacation and then he's living his life. So
wow,
he's
really
able to travel and do the things. He's retired, so he gets around.
I never thought about the idea, you know, obviously with chemo in colon cancer, we had all those old trials on treatment holidays. I never thought about checkpoint treatment holidays.
You know, I think it has to be individualized, right? So if you have a patient like this who's clearly been going for so long that he needs a break on occasion, and this is the kind of patient where I'm very comfortable doing that. There's just, once we got past 6 months, and that was the interesting thing, we saw some response early on, and then even better response by 6 months. After that, he hasn't really, the lesions are there, they're not shrinking. We scan him every 4 months or so, and so we get a sense that, you know, the best response is, I don't think we're going to make him a complete response no matter what we do.
You know, obviously, more and more we're seeing patients who in the past really had poor prognoses, you know, occasionally have things like this happen, particularly with checkpoint inhibitors. We usually focus on all the data, the trials, et cetera. I'm just kind of curious at a human level how this played out in this man. What did you observe in terms of what it actually meant to him to be able to go through this response?
Yeah, I mean, he's overjoyed. I mean, before the checkpoint inhibitor, he was progressing on FOLFOX and FOLFIR. And, you know, I think it's very interesting how field changes so quickly. And just like you said, in a human level, he was told, you know, he had those tough discussions that, you know, we have a continuing growth of your liver metastases and we have very few options. And he was offered, you know, to some trials or some other drugs that are available. But, you know, these patients are very gratifying, and we all wish there were more of these MSI high now, because these are few and far between, unfortunately.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, some of the clinical research strategies trying to get more out of checkpoint inhibitors, both in MSI high as well as MSS tumors. There are some, you know, trials out there looking at MEK inhibitors, et cetera. But in both of these, what are some of the clinical trial strategies right now that you feel optimistic about?
You know, the challenge, I think, in MSI high is in many ways the success of single agent checkpoint inhibitors makes it very difficult to do much better. And by that, I mean, every drug company wants to add their second drug or their better checkpoint inhibitor looking at MSI high. And to me, you know, it's not that every patient responds as durably as this patient, but there's enough of a response in majority's patients that I find it difficult to imagine that a double checkpoint inhibitor or a double immunotherapy strategy, when you weigh in the toxicity and cost of these drugs, is going to be the best approach. And, you know, that's a struggle because everybody wants these MSI high patients now on their studies, obviously. The MSS patients are obviously the exact opposite in the sense that we know that single checkpoint inhibitors don't have any activity, and there's all this interest amongst every company out there pretty much in trying to make these tumors immunoresponsive. But they're, you know, there's a reason they don't respond to immunotherapy, and it's very challenging to turn these kind of patients to immunosensitive diseases, I think. So there's a lot of strategies out there, and, you know, obviously some include chemotherapy backbones together with immunotherapy, some include double immunotherapy strategies, and some include immunotherapy plus targeted therapy strategies. I think the key will be to think about the cancers that are not quite MSI, but have some characteristics that would make them sensitive to checkpoint inhibitors or other immunotherapeutic strategies. So, you know, looking at now in the field of colon cancer, there's been a lot of progress in subclassifying tumors, whether it's based on CMS subtype, which is a popular thing now, or other subtypes. There are groups that theoretically are more likely to respond to checkpoint inhibitors, and maybe not by single agents, but in combination. So that's where I think the potential holds.
You mentioned combination immunotherapy, and of course, in many different cancers, we hear about anti-PD-1, anti-CTLA-4. Has that been looked at either with MSI high or MSS tumors?
I mean, I think it has been looked at in MSS, and there's been no suggestion of any activity. In MSI high, it's also been looked at. And again, there is some suggestion, and I think that data has been presented with IPI and Nivo, that there is a better response, perhaps, as indicated by response rate. Questions become challenging when you start to consider the additional toxicities, because adding a CTLA-4 inhibitor is a much more, in my opinion, toxic and challenging regimen, particularly for durability, than single agent PD-1 inhibitors alone. So, you know, the question is the extra small, perhaps, prolongation of PFS in very small numbers going to be worth the toxicity and the extra cost? That's a challenging question.
Just kind of curious, I've been hearing mention of the so-called biome in colon cancer and the bowel in general and the research that's going on there. Just thought I'd give you an opportunity if you have any interest or thoughts about that.
I mean, it's very interesting. It's, I think, probably unique to the GI system. So in many ways, if we're looking at GI malignancies, and perhaps not just colon cancer, but gastric cancer as well, the microbiome's always been this area of interest, and the challenge is understanding it better and developing therapeutic strategies against it. I think we're still a ways away from that point. But, you know, there is good logic in trying to target the microbiome or using the microbiome as a way to develop some new drugs. I think the research is pretty provocative, but very preliminary still.
So just kind of curious how you would think through this man's case if he were to come in with clear-cut disease progression.
If he progresses on a checkpoint inhibitor, because I have thought about this, and, you know, I said to myself, if this man progresses on a checkpoint inhibitor, given the lung... See, when I have an MSI-high patient who's been on therapy for a long time on a checkpoint inhibitor, I think that's the perfect candidate for some sort of enhanced immunotherapeutic strategy. So because he was on for so long, adding perhaps a second checkpoint inhibitor or changing around the checkpoint inhibitors that are out there makes sense, because as opposed to going back to chemotherapy, at least for now. Because to me, if you have an MSI-high phenotype, you're clearly more likely to respond to these strategies. I have had a patient who progressed, and it's not like I've had a number of patients who have been on checkpoint inhibitors and then they progress, and the progression is not usually as dramatic in my experience as it is when you progress with MSS cancer, in the sense that you have, you know, very little time to make your decisions. Here there is some opportunity to look around and find some better strategies.
You were talking about further immunotherapy on a trial, or you think you might think of something outside a trial?
At that point, I would probably try to find the trial, because so the only thing you could really do off trial that is easy to do, I suppose, is combine the CTLA-4 at that point. And that's something to consider if you can have that option and if the toxicity is worth it. So you could add IPI to that regimen based on that previous data. There are other checkpoint inhibitors out there now that are distinct from PD-1 and CTLA-4 that actually look promising, whether it's TIGIT or one of these other checkpoints adjacent to the PD-1 blockade. And, you know, once you identify a patient as being immunosensitive, as rare as it is in this disease, I think it makes sense to consider at that point another strategy.
What's your usual approach in general to patients once they get beyond FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, BEV, EGFR, if indicated?
In MSS patients, you mean? In all comers?
Yeah.
So in patients that progress on all that chemotherapy, I tend to use, outside of a trial, if there's no options, I tend to use TAS-102 in that patient. So in the patients who have been on standard chemotherapy, which is the large majority of our patients, of course, I prefer personally using TAS-102 as opposed to regorafenib, if that's the sequence of decisions that need to be made.
Any clinical pearls that you have that maybe you pass on to your fellows about using TAS-102?
You know, I find TAS-102 to be a little bit easier in regorafenib, obviously, in toxicity profile, because I think we're much more comfortable dealing with the cytopenias that might emerge. I think at that point, a large majority of the patients are obviously different shape and not clearly... I tell our fellows, we're not shooting for the moon here, unfortunately. We have to be very practical with this and, you know, consider this something that is hopefully going to stabilize the disease. But still, if you look at the data, a good chunk of the patients will progress at first scan. So don't go overboard with the cytopenias and toxicity in a patient like that, where you're really not shooting for a response, quite frankly. The majority of the patients will not respond.
How do you approach the issue of cytopenia, specifically neutropenia? And what about the patient who's been heavily pretreated? Do you see more problems there?
Yeah. I mean, we always see more problems in those patients. So I think that, you know, we tend to come down to the next dose level down pretty fast in that drug, assuming they're on the regular schedule, 5 days on, 2 days off, 5 days on, 2 days off. Typically, after their first 4 weeks of therapy, their second go-around, a lot of the patients will have one drop in the dose reduction if the cytopenias are becoming an issue. Because the last thing the patients want to have to deal with is coming in and worrying about a CBC twice a week. So if you can avoid that at that point... And, you know, I often find CEA to be valuable in those patients that are, you know, in a situation where they're in the absence of any clinical progression, using that as a way of looking for disease stabilization too.
You mentioned regorafenib. First of all, how often do you see your, do your patients end up getting both sequentially, TAS-102 and then regorafenib?
I'd say increasingly rarely. And by that, I mean, I think that even though those both drugs are FDA approved, it's difficult to have a patient that is in sufficiently good condition that's going to get through both of those salvage drugs. So I'd say it's my experience, it's only about 10% of patients that I find that are, you know, where the toxicity profile and the benefit is in that situation worth doing.
What is your experience with regorafenib and how do you dose the drug?
So, you know, and regorafenib, we all know, is a, in many ways a, not an easy drug to dose, whether it's the patient population that we're tested it in, or the drug itself has some toxicity, some of which are not grade 3 toxicities, but clearly affect quality of life. I start every patient personally at 120, so I do not start on the package label FDA-approved dosage of 160. I find that I maybe saw one patient who can handle 160, and if they did, I started them on 120 and then put them on 160. So 120 milligrams of regorafenib to me is where I start the majority of my patients. And some patients need to go down quickly to 80 milligrams. And a lot of patients can hang in there at 120, at least until we see if the drug is doing any clinical benefit.
I want to move on and ask you to comment on the issue of RAS testing in colon cancer.
I think for about 10 years now, or more than 10 years, that RAS oncogenes are certainly the dominant oncogene in cancer. And in particular in GI cancers, colorectal cancer, this is the most relevant, I would say. RAS is a very complicated protein, as we all know. But generally speaking, it's divided into HRAS, NRAS, and KRAS. And KRAS mutations make up the bulk of them in exons 2, 3. The NRAS is a relatively newer, I'd say, in the last 5 years, where it became clear that there's a subset of patients that have NRAS mutations as well. And those are also all the same point mutations. So if we look at colon cancer, I think, and we all know that about 40 to 45% of patients will have a RAS mutation, and perhaps a little bit higher when you add in NRAS now. So it's nearly half patients will have some degree of mutations in one of the RAS oncogenes. They're usually in certain codons, as we all know, 12, 13, 61 are the most common. And I think nowadays it's a good idea, obviously, when we test for RAS, to ask the pathology to do whether we want to call it all RAS testing or extended RAS testing. And that usually includes all of the KRAS codons as well as NRAS and BRAF.
Could I just ask, how much of this information would you get from a next-gen sequencing assay like Foundation One?
Oh, you get all of it. So you would get that standard now to look at Foundation, or even, you know, a lot of internal hospital pathology departments will be able to give us. Certainly everybody knows how to do KRAS, and I would say NRAS and BRAF are becoming more frequent even in community pathologist hospitals because they're very easy to isolate. Certainly any NGS will give you, if they have an NRAS mutation, that's going to be on there. So we know that RAS is, you know, like I said, the dominant oncogene in colon cancer and presumably plays an important role in the progression of the disease. And I think most of the data, if you look sort of an aggregate at the literature, there's pretty good concordance between studies and there's pretty good concordance between the sensitivity and the ability between the concordance between a metastasis, for example, and a primary tumor. It's not perfect, of course, but it's pretty good at this point.
I was curious about this point you made here about KRAS being, you know, part of the evolution of polyps.
Yeah, so if you look at the old typical Vogelstein, Bert Vogelstein hypothesis progression from polyp all the way through adenoma, through abnormal, whether it's dysplasia, and ultimately neoplasia. RAS is on that progression and fairly early, actually, in the point between when the mucosa changes. So it's right after APC, I think, in terms of the frequency with which that has been observed. And some studies have shown, pretty elegant scientific studies show, that it's common to occur along that progression. And this is the bulk of the patients that have RAS mutations, colorectal, lung, and pancreas. We know that, for example, in pancreatic cancer, virtually 95% of them have a KRAS mutation. And in colon cancer, it's about, like we said, about 40% or so. And it's usually G12D and G12V and G13. And so those are the typical ones that when you look at the hotspot analysis or whatever mechanism we're using to look at RAS, you're going to see those present. Lung also, 25%. So I think everything we learned from lung cancer in these situations should be also extrapolated on some level to colon cancer. We certainly know that the pathway pretty well, the MAP kinase pathway, that blocking RAS and would be a nice attractive idea in theory, and it's just upstream of BRAF. So patients that have RAS mutations do not have BRAF mutations as well. As you know, those in colon cancer are mutually exclusive. So blocking BRAF, if you have a BRAF mutation, at least in, or I should say in the testing mechanism, a lot of centers do not test for BRAF if you already have a RAS mutation.
Is there anything about the pathophysiology or the pathology of colorectal cancer that you can point out in terms of why it doesn't seem to kind of respond the way, say, melanoma or lung cancer does to anti-BRAF treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we know that BRAF mutant colon cancer is so different from BRAF mutant melanoma, both probably biologically, and all the animal models and research has suggested all sorts of, even if you block BRAF in these patients, you have immediate increased pathway activation of some other pathways, whether it's PI3 kinase or EGFR, and that was the impetus behind the combination trials in the early going. But I think to me, you know, it's certainly, even in the BRAF mutant colon cancer patients, the notion of true oncogene addiction is less relevant here than in some of these other cancers that you alluded to. And so blocking one single pathway in colon cancer has not been fruitful in our experience so far, as you know. Even in the BRAF mutant combination studies, you see that the patients do progress, and often much quicker than they did in other BRAF mutant malignancies. So if you're talking about the BRAF, I think it's a totally different paradigm than these other cancers. It's really not as dependent on that pathway. It's dependent on the pathway, but not to the same extent as some of these other cancers.
Can you comment on the issue of drug development to treat KRAS mutant colon cancer?
There's been probably dozens of companies and lots of money spent on anti-KRAS strategies, which is a big challenge, obviously. It's not the easy and most druggable target, as we all know. We imagine that blocking this target in a successful, durable way that can be administered to patients would be a good approach to treating KRAS mutant cancers, although we don't know, to be fair, because very few of those drugs have made it to the point where they can be administered safely or we're confident that they sufficiently block the pathway. Some efforts have made the assumption, well, if you block downstream with a MEK inhibitor, well, that certainly will cover your RAS mutant cancers, but that hasn't been the case, as we all know. MEK inhibitors as single agents have not shown any activity at all in RAS mutant colon cancer and pancreas cancer. So efforts to block RAS are, you know, that's why great scientists are spending their careers dedicated to that problem, and there are a lot of them. And I think there is a way to figure it out, and it's just going to take some new pharmacology, new drug delivery mechanism maybe. There's some excitement in the immunotherapy community about thinking about RAS not as a druggable target with a typical drug, but rather with some adoptive T-cell strategies. So there is some excitement in this field that is renewed. We all want to see some durable RAS inhibitor make it to the point where it can be given to patients and be sustained.
So I wanted to ask you, kind of get your viewpoint on a couple other common questions that come up with colorectal cancer. One is the issue of duration of adjuvant chemotherapy in the 3 versus 6 month question. I was just wondering if you had any patient you've seen, let's say since ASCO, where you actually utilized the 3 months that you could maybe briefly present.
I did. I've had a couple where this has already come up. And, you know, the data to me, it's a bit hard to figure out what's going on there. I mean, I find that it's an incredible data set and an incredible endeavor that the international GI community put together here. I mean, we'll never have that again, probably. And the IDEA collaboration, I think, is so unique that people don't realize how many patients went into this. It's unbelievable. But I took home from that what a lot of people took home from that, which is that 3 months of chemotherapy in some people is probably just as good. And those people are typically the lower risk. So the N1 patients, the patients with 2 lymph nodes or below, who you know that oxaliplatin is going to induce worse neuropathy if you keep it going. And up until last year, every patient you told them very straightforward, FOLFOX for 6 months, that was the end of the story. And I think what I take out of that is, you know, with these N1 patients, I had one just a few weeks ago where I'm planning to give that patient 3 months of FOLFOX.
Could you briefly present right off the top of your head that patient, what happened?
So that's a patient, a very straightforward patient that we all see every day. This is a patient who came into the office having had a left hemicolectomy for a sigmoid cancer, had 2 out of 24 lymph nodes positive, so 55-year-old lady, intelligent, full-time working attorney, and has a typical presentation of colon cancer in the sense that, you know, some obstruction type of GI symptoms with a little bit of rectal bleeding, gets taken for a scope and shows a mass in the sigmoid colon, no metastasis. It's a great situation in many ways for that patient. She gets taken quickly to the operating room. and a very moderately typical, I'd call it a bland colon cancer, the ones we're familiar with seeing often, which is a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma is removed with 2 out of 24 lymph nodes positive. No other warning signs there in terms of suggestion of any metastatic disease.
Just out of curiosity, did you ever had a screening colonoscopy?
No, she was in her early 50s, and not yet is the answer I got.
Just out of curiosity, you know, she's an attorney, intelligent, I guess. Any regrets that she expressed to you about not getting screened?
I mean, I asked her if this was her prior colonoscopy, and it was the typical answer. It's been on my list of things to do.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of patients, we all know that they are told over and over to get their screening colonoscopies, and, you know, they're reluctant to do it. And you're right. I mean, that's a patient who maybe a few years ago had stage one colon cancer or something like that. Who knows? There are some regrets, but I think that, you know, the positive side of it is that she's still very good chance likely cured as well.
So she's N1, she's got two positive nodes. What about the choice of therapy and specifically whether you use capecitabine or 5-FU?
So I will usually use FOLFOX. I mean, I'd say if I had to look at my patients, it's probably 3/4 to 1/4 FOLFOX over CAPOX. I just find it easier for the majority of patients in terms of toxicity profile. And especially in someone who's undergone surgery, I'm always worried about getting adequate capecitabine doses in.
I've heard people say that in this, you know, incredible analysis that the 3 months of capecitabine looked better somehow, or at least the CAPOX, the way it was delivered, looked better. Do you buy into that, or you think that's sort of overinterpreting?
I don't know what to make of that yet, other than I think we all know that capecitabine dosing and tolerability is a little bit different in Europe than it is in the United States. So it's a European patients for the most part. And in the United States, for a bunch of reasons, as we all know, that getting to those big doses of capecitabine isn't easy. So when you're trying to treat for a cure, sometimes I often will go for FOLFOX. Now, in this patient, I did start with CAPOX because she was so opposed to having a port placed or a PICC line placed. So we did decide to do CAPOX, and after one cycle, I switched her to FOLFOX because the problem became, as happens in a lot of patients, that getting that adequate dose of capecitabine in for 2 weeks, she started to develop a lot of GI toxicity and a lot of colitis type of picture, diarrhea, and hand-foot syndrome. And she's not DPD deficient or anything. It's just, in some people, a tough combination. And she had the expectation that she'd be fully working during this period because she didn't have a portacath or a PICC line. And then after seeing her response to this combination, I told her the easiest and safest way for you to get through these next 3 months and to do it properly will be to do FOLFOX. So I talked her into that.
What dose capecitabine did you use?
So I used 1 g/m² BID. So it came to, I don't remember the exact dosing in her, but it was at least 1,500 BID, which isn't a huge dose, but it might have been actually 4 and 4 even. You know, I think capecitabine is, in some people, the right choice, and in some people, isn't. And the way I approach it is, if a patient is able to swallow pills and they want to try it, I try it for the most part. But I find that a lot of patients, if you really want to get them properly through their adjuvant therapy, you sometimes have to make some decisions there, which include either dose reducing your capecitabine to the point where you're worried that you're not getting adequate dosage or switching them off of it.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, your views are very similar to what, you know, I've heard from other GI cancer investigators. And yet I would guess that if you did a patient preference survey, you would find people, I mean, theoretically, assuming it was the same side effects, which, as you say, maybe is an issue, that there would be anything about this woman, you know, a strong preference not to have a port, et cetera. And I just wonder, I realize it's in the curative setting, but also, you know, the benefit, how much additional benefit you get by, you know, sort of pushing the dose, you know, of course we don't know, but I kind of wonder about, and, you know, thinking back to what you were saying before about regorafenib, obviously different situation, palliative, but yet, you know, the idea of starting at a dose you know will be tolerable, maybe working your way up, I guess that just doesn't wash in the, quote, curative setting.
Right. I mean, I think it's harder to justify doing that in the curative setting because you know, and perhaps the number isn't as great as we would like, but you know there are some patients here, you're going to cure them with chemotherapy, just like in any adjuvant scenario. And particularly in a young patient, we try to push the envelope and try to give them really the proper dosage. And who knows what that dose is, to be fair. The other problem with CAPOX in the adjuvant setting, as you know, is that that dose of oxaliplatin every 3 weeks at 130 per meter squared isn't easy either. So, you know, sometimes I find that that interest in not having the pump or the port and all that is an emotional reaction and not based on, you know, the practical reality, which is let's just get you through this safely and well and do it properly. So it's interesting. You have seen some switch away from, if you look nationally, from CAPOX to FOLFOX, and whether it's adjuvant or metastatic, and, you know, as more people start thinking about it a little differently.
So a little known fact, you know, our group does a lot of surveys, and we've presented many posters at ASCO and other meetings on just, you know, kind of asking people what they do and stuff. We had one data set that I actually presented orally at the ASCO GI meeting a few years ago, and I completely screwed up the whole presentation. I got lost in the slides. It was totally out of my element, but it was kind of an interesting study. I don't know if you ever, probably not.
I remember some of the details.
Oh, really? Anyhow, I actually ended up getting commented on. I think we had a poster discussion at ASCO this year, but, you know, we had a lot of experience in breast cancer and seeing the literature on how breast cancer patients make adjuvant decisions. So we actually surveyed some patients with colon cancer who'd gotten adjuvant therapy and said, you know, thinking about that experience, how much of a benefit would you have needed to see in order to justify going through this kind of therapy? And, you know, in breast cancer, they found that there were a cohort of patients who would go through the chemo for just a very, very minimal benefit. So I don't know, do you know what we saw with the study?
I'm going to guess. But, I mean, we know that in breast cancer, you know, patients will endure greater toxic regimens for smaller benefit. And the adjuvant colon cancer data is stronger in terms of number needed to treat and all of those variables. So I'm guessing that you found that a larger percentage of patients would go through it again.
Well, actually, what was interesting, there were a couple things that we found. First of all, that about a third of the patients would go through it for a 1% reduction in risk of recurrence, but 10% of the patients would not go through it for like a 10% absolute benefit. So we saw, you know, both sides of the spectrum. I think the most interesting thing that we saw, I was really curious, was, you know, after all this stuff in breast cancer, was whether there's going to be a difference in men or women. And we found no difference. The attitudes were the same. And I'm just kind of curious if that in any way reflects what you see in day-to-day practice in terms of the variation. We didn't see a lot of age difference, incidentally, although, you know, maybe it wasn't perfect science. But I'm just kind of curious how you see people, you know, this 55-year-old lady and other patients kind of coming into these adjuvant decisions.
I see no difference in gender. I personally see... You know, we see each gender equally in our disease, and I see no difference in how they approach the topic or how they think about it. You know, your data will be particularly interesting in light of the 3 versus 6 question, because presumably that 10% will go down dramatically. You know, I think, look, it's always hard to have that adjuvant discussion. It's a conceptual discussion. It's hard for patients to understand who are outside of the field. You know, we teach our fellows to talk to patients about the concept of an insurance policy and all of those kind of typical teaching points. But, you know, it's a tough discussion. And I find that, though, in this day and age, the very, very large majority of patients will choose some therapy because they've been able to understand that they've either seen people or know people who have had a cancer come back, and they want to avoid that fate. And so there's a lot of buy-in to that point. And I think the 3 months is going to help, because I think that when I tell patients, oh, you're going to need adjuvant chemotherapy, and they say, for how long? And I tell them 6 months, I see their face drop, because a lot of them think they're out of the woods and they're done. We all know that they get referred from the surgeon, it's great, we got it all, it's done. A lot of them think it's over. And some of the surgeons will say, well, you know, go talk to your oncologist about the pros and cons of chemotherapy, which is, and then we come in and we always say, with rare exception, patients with positive lymph node and colon cancer, we always push the chemo. Whether it's, you could have a debate on FOLFOX, ZLOX, or single agent or doublets, but we always say, you got to get something. And so they come in a little bit shocked with the duration, I find, because some of them have this concept that it's going to be a few months shorter. So now I think you can have that discussion, and that's a nuanced discussion that I think should be individualized to the degree of risk, just like some of the other things we do in stage 2 colon cancer. It's the rare patient now with stage 2 colon cancer gets treated, but I would say it's the high risk. So in the same way, if I have a patient with 8 positive lymph nodes, I'm not having usually a discussion yet about 3 months. So,
and as you say, you know, it's really interesting. We should go back and do a study like this on 3 versus 6 months, because then it'd be interesting to interview people who got neuropathy, you know, that hasn't gone away with 6 months in terms of, you know, how much is that worth to them. What about any ethnic? I know there's a big Asian population in your area. Any difference ethnically?
Yeah, I mean, we see a big diversity here of patients. And, you know, in big urban centers, there's sometimes a little more skepticism about chemotherapy, as you know, whether it's holistic approaches or alternative approaches. We get a lot of patients who are opposed to chemotherapy. So we do get some of that no way, no how type of answer. But I'd say ethnically, there's no differences. We see, you know, no differences in terms of their willingness to accept it.
You know, it's interesting, too, the whole dynamic of the adjuvant decision. You have it in lung cancer and breast cancer. I was just reflecting on the fact that yesterday I was interviewing Hal Burstein from Dana-Farber, a breast cancer investigator. He presented a case to me, this woman who came in wanting to get adjuvant chemo, feeling she needed it. He does an Oncotype DX assay on her, and it's low. And he says, you don't need chemo. And then she turns around and says, well, I still want it. And, you know, he said, you know, probably the risk of secondary leukemia or whatever is going to be greater than the benefit. And yet, you know, that idea of the regret of if a patient develops a recurrence, I guess, is so dominant in this situation.
Yeah, I think it's more dominant in breast cancer, to be honest. Because, I mean, in colon cancer, we really, you know, it's not as much decision-making goes into the decision, fundamentally. It's been, until now, a pretty clear consensus that patients with stage 3 colon cancer get 6 months of FOLFOX or CAPOX. And so, you know, maybe now we're going to have to start having those nuanced discussions, but it's not going to be about chemo versus no chemo. It's going to be about 3 versus 6. And what's very interesting is, you know, what there are, I feel, this group of patients, and there's no data on this yet, or not long-term data, but where maybe the 3 versus 6 is okay if you drop the Oxali, but maybe some of them should get 6 of the 5 FU type of thing.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Because it is, you know, the toxicity is pretty much from the Oxali at that point. So I don't know if too many studies have looked at that or whether that's something of future study. I think it is. But this data set, which is the IDEA data set, is such a robust thing. They should be able to milk that for a lot of subset analysis to really nail down who are the people, you know, who don't need that 6 months.